Hello, 13 jurors. Brandi Churchwell here with your final update on the trial of Thomas Randolph. When we left off, the video interview from June 3rd of 2008 had just ended, and at that point, none of us had any questions about what a pig Tommy Boy is. Lead Detective Dean O'Kelly is still on the stand. He's walking the jury through his investigation, or at least the parts that they're allowed to know about, because remember, they are not allowed to know about any of the prior bad acts or his previous trials. They bring up the fact that Tom called Detective O'Kelly an a-hole when he was over at the house for a keep the peace situation where the locks were being changed by Colleen. They talk about how he told Detective O'Kelly that he blew the investigation, and he asked him how much longer the investigation was going to take, and about how Tom complained about Sharon's gambling, the way she spent money, any money that he gave her, having to spend taxes for Sharon's late husband, and basically anything and everything related to money, which brings us to the next topic. They bring out some records for the gambling cards and credit cards and all of the finances. I'm not going to go over each one line by line. I'll just give you kind of the totals. On Tom's gambling report, there wasn't a lot. I think it was like April 9th to May 9th or something like that. His total was only $462.50. Sharon's, on the other hand, was over $23,000. Mike's was, I think, around $1,900, but that one was from February to May, not from April to May. So Tom and Mike both have pretty small amounts on theirs, but Sharon did like to gamble. Everybody has said that. So hers was about $23,468 for 1 month. That was the last month of her life. They went over the bank accounts. They had a joint bank account through Wells Fargo. And at the end of April of 2008, it had just over $1,000 in it. And at the end of May, it had about $2,300 in it. At the end of each of those months, the total liabilities were about $40,000. They also bring up Tom's bank account. In his bank account that was opened August in 2007, he had deposited $118,000 into the bank to open the account. And that same month, he ended with about $90,000. But his ending balance in that account right before Sharon's death was $15.35. Now, for his credit cards, they went over them line by line, but I'm not going to do that. There are a bit of them, and I'll just tell you that they total about $85,000, which they said is also about the same as the home equity line of credit. The life insurance that he was going to be collecting is supposed to be about $332,000, I think is what it was. And Also, he's thinking he's going to be collecting the house and anything in her bank accounts. Now, all the talk about money kind of gives a little bit of an insight into the theory of motive. He didn't like the way she spent money. He felt like she had spent her 401k and she was spending all of the money that she had. He complained about how she spent the money that she got from her late husband's life insurance policy. I mean, he gets visibly irritated in police interviews talking about how she spent money. And even after she's long gone, he complains to everybody about how she spent money. By laying everything out as far as his irritation with the way she spends money and the way she gambles, and everything that he brings up with money constantly, and everything he stood to gain from her death, the state does a pretty good job of laying out their theory of this being for financial gain. I'll be honest, Detective Dean O'Kelly was a fantastic witness. He stayed very calm. He was very matter of fact. He gave factual answers. He did a great job. So there's not a lot that defense had to work with. But, you know, they gotta give it a go. So he gets up and starts cross-examination. He tries to point out the good stuff, like anything that he can do to kind of score some points for his client. He says that they would agree that Mike Miller is the one who shot Sharon Randolph, and that Tom had said he had been to the charcoal room, which is the steakhouse they went to at the Santa Fe, and he said that the video shows it to be true, so that was a true statement. He points out that Tom talked to them without an attorney, and that he even saw Tom and Sharon on the video holding hands as they were leaving their date. Then he starts trying to pick holes. His first attempt at this is when he's talking about the video footage from where Tom and Sharon are leaving the gas station after their date. Now, look, this whole thing is a non-issue, but he's got to do what he can, I guess, to try to poke any holes or make anything look like it's not what it is or like it's not believable or something. I don't know. But it's a non-issue and he spends a lot of time on it. And I want to kind of picture this. He's pacing around the courtroom like he just can't wait to get this out. And he's so frustrated that this happened. But it's a non-issue. So it's kind of like a lot of dramatics for nothing. His whole point is that the video time that they said that the car pulled out and left the gas station, the name of the gas station is Funny's. So the time that they left Funny's was like 8:26. But he has this moment where he's like, aha, gotcha. Because the car is said to leave at 8:26. But really, they stopped at a stoplight. So it was really closer to 8:27. Okay, no, that's not how it works. They said that he left at 8:26. He left the gas station at 8:26. Stopping at the stoplight is part of the drive home, so it's not that moment that I think he was hoping it would be. His next attempt at doing this and trying to destroy the timeline, as he calls it, is the neighbor's testimony, Mark Bartlett. Now, he makes a comment about how he was on the phone when he saw the car pull up and he watched it go in or whatever. But that's not what he said. He didn't say he was on the phone when he saw the car pull up. He said that as the car was going into the garage, his phone rang. Regardless, again, we know that he heard the shots while he was on the phone. So these mere seconds or maybe a minute that he's squabbling over don't matter. We have the phone records. We know there's a 4 to 4.5 minute period where those shots happened, tops. So again, it's this drama over nothing. Next, he talks about the lack of bullet strikes or blood or anything like that in the hallway where Tom said he was shooting at Mike. He basically says since one of the bullets entered into Mike's body but did not exit it, that could have been a shot that hit him while he was in the hallway, which would explain why there were no bullet marks or blood. Which, okay, one of those could explain that. But if you'll remember, we heard in that bizarre walkthrough and in about 15 of the different times that Tommy told the story about how he just shot and shot and shot while he was in the hallway. So yeah, one could be explained, but not as many as Tom said that he shot. The next thing he does is go into kind of an attack mode on Mike Miller. He keeps calling him a thief, and he said that he had the ID on him with a Costco card that didn't have his name, And he told Detective O'Kelly, this is how we know he's a thief, right? Detective O'Kelly was kind of like, well, yeah, it doesn't belong to him, but we don't know how he got it. And he's obviously not here to speak up for himself or to, you know, give us any kind of explanation. So we don't know how he got it. So we can't just assume that. He does this thing again where he has like this big moment where he almost acts like he's, you know, got Detective O'Kelly right where he wants him. And he's talking about this ID that they found in Mike Miller's pocket. And the name of the ID, the guy was named Mike Hoag, Michael Hoag. So he's talking to him about it. And he's like, so you never even thought to go interview him? It was almost like so theatrical that it was a little bit like embarrassing to watch. You know, him interviewing Michael Hoag doesn't make Tom any less guilty of what he did. So it's another one of those non-issues that he's kind of treating like a gotcha moment. But again, I'm trying to be understanding because I know he don't have a whole lot to work with here. But then just when I'm trying to be understanding about it, he does it yet again over the jewelry not being appraised. Now, look, in one of the wills, Sharon even said that the jewelry that she has is not really, like, valuable for monetary purposes, but it has sentimental value. And a lot of the stuff you can look at and tell it's costume jewelry, or cosmetic jewelry, as they like to call it. But regardless, it's not that big of a deal. It's not one of those things that is going to make a difference in this case, but it's something that he harps on with another fake gotcha moment. He disputes the importance of the timing on the garage light about how if it goes off after 5 minutes and 8 seconds, and Tom said in the walkthrough and in the first interview that he hit the button when he came in and saw Sharon, that it's not that strange that the light went off when he said he was in there. Well, that would be true if when he came in, it had been 5 minutes later, because the timing of it, it is strange because it goes against everything he said. It's another one of those inconsistencies on the timeline that defense is trying to poke holes in, but it's just not working for them. Funny how it's hard to poke holes in the truth. They continue their attack against Mike Miller and bring up the fact that he had cocaine that had been metabolized in his system. And he said that Tom had repeatedly said that Mike didn't have a drug problem, but yet here he was, a thief with drugs in his system. He also says that since there were no bloody footprints around Sharon's body, that the drawers that had been pulled out in the bedroom beside her had to have been pulled out before she got there, because if they had been staged afterwards, there would be bloody footprints. He also tries to say that Tom was so worried about Sharon. He was just so worried about how long it took them to get there. And he wanted to know if she died instantly. And he was so worried about her laying on the floor. Now, I'm not even going to take the time to point out how we know that all of that is a load of BS, because we've already been over this. But trying to paint him in this light of being a loving, caring, distraught husband is the farthest stretch that he possibly could have gone with this. He should have stuck to reasonable doubt, not unreasonable character. He also makes a huge deal about how there must have been a getaway driver because they didn't find a bike there. He actually insinuates that Mike's girlfriend, who, by the way, has never been any kind of suspect in any kind of anything to do with this case, how she could have been out there waiting as the getaway driver. In what was probably one of my absolute favorite Detective Dean O'Kelly moments, the defense shows him a picture from July where he's pointing to the wall where there's some arrows that are showing where blood spatter was, and he's showing it to Colleen. Rather than tell you, I really want you to listen to this clip.
Yes or no, Detective? Are you in that photo explaining the crime scene to Colleen and her child, yes or no?
No. I'm explaining what happened to her mom.
I love that moment. And the reason that I love it so much is because I think that it's Detective O'Kelly really just stopping the defense attorney and making this not about a crime scene, but he's explaining what happened to this woman's mother. This is a daughter who is hearing what happened in the final moments to her mother. It's more than a crime scene. And that moment where he's honoring the victim is just one of my favorite moments. During redirect, the prosecutor is able to clear up a couple of things. He points out that the phone call of the neighbor, Mark Bartlett, was from 8:33 until about 8:38, not 8:45, so him squabbling over that minute or two doesn't really make any difference. He points out that there was only one penetrating gunshot wound, and the rest of them had an exit wound, so that was also a moot point. And he points out that the garage light timer being 5 minutes and 8 seconds, no matter what, there is no part of the story that still makes that make sense. The ski mask was a big deal, too. He points out that there were no bullet holes or blood anywhere in or around the ski mask. And he points out that the entire time during the walkthrough, never once did Tom show any emotion or become sad or cry or weep or look like a grieving husband. He did, however, say it was the grossest thing he had ever seen in his life. And he talked about Sharon leaving her shoes in the hallway and complained about it, which is basically what we've come to expect from him anyway. So with that, the state rests, and now the defense is up. Their first witness is their star witness. Just kidding, they don't have a star witness. They don't have a case. Michael Hoag is their first witness, and he is the one, if you remember, has the ID and the Costco card and the food stamps card that was found in the front pocket of Michael Miller when he was taken in for his autopsy. He kind of looked like he didn't really know why he had to be there, and they started out his testimony by talking about all of the felonies that he's had in the last 10 years. And really, the only thing that he even said was that he lost his wallet or his wallet was taken or whatever when he was traveling from Los Angeles to Las Vegas and he fell asleep on a bus and woke up and his bag was gone. And that was it. That was it. Their only other witness is Jeremy Stafford. Now, you may recognize the name. He's the host of The Best Defense on the Outdoor Channel. Now, let me be clear. Jeremy Stafford's credentials are impressive, and I have no problem with him as a person or as a witness, but his testimony is kind of useless, and I'll explain why. Jeremy has an impressive resume. Marine Corps, Bronze Star with V for Valor. He worked 25 years with LAPD as a firearms expert. He's got extensive operational and instructional experience. He worked at Police Academy where he developed and updated lesson plans and programs, including the Handgun Inspector Training School and the Multiple Attack Counter-Terror Action Capabilities curriculum. He spent 14 years in the Marine Corps, actually, and in the Marine Corps Reserve, and he had been deployed in Iraq, Southeast Asia, Africa. I mean, you name it. I could keep going. He's also the handgun editor for Guns and Ammo magazine, and he has extensive research in officer-involved shootings. Now, here's where my problem comes in with him as a witness. Tommy ain't a cop, y'all. The things that Jeremy Stafford is testifying to are not things that apply to Tom in any way, shape, or form. Now, he gives great testimony about perceptual distortion. Basically, when you go into crisis mode, your brain kind of doesn't really process things the same as it would if you are just a normal, rational person in the moment. So your perceptions may be distorted because of adrenaline or whatever else. Examples, you can have auditory exclusion, where you're kind of like aware that something's causing a sound, but you can't really hear it, like if you shoot, but you didn't hear the gun. Or tunnel vision, so like if you're like hyper-focused on what's in front of you, so much that you can take in details around it. Or time distortion, so things can seem to slow down. There's heightened visual acuity, so like things that you focus on, you can see like crazy, crazy detail. Or distance distortion, where you see something that's not there or remember differently than what it was. For example, like you can remember the color of a hat differently or something like that. Now, the number of rounds that are fired or distance or time frames, obvious things like that can be missed. These are all examples of kind of what he's talking about. Now look, what he's saying is all absolutely true. I don't dispute it at all. But it doesn't apply here. These are examples of things that can be distorted and the stress that you're under when you are, for example, under attack. He even gave the example of when he was in combat and he had somebody coming at him. That is a high crisis situation. It's not the same thing when you walk into a planned murder. To me, it seems like they are using a decorated Marine who is likable, knowledgeable, honorable, and experienced, and they're trying to use that as an explanation for what Tom did. Tom is none of those things. None of them. And that's exactly what they point out during cross-examination. The prosecutor gets up there, and he basically points out the testimony that he's given is about officer-involved shootings and their perception in those situations. Those instances have been thrust onto people that are involved. The situation came to the person. This is very different. It's very different if the person involved in the situation is the person who created it. So if someone, say, stages this whole thing, then it's not going to be the same reaction as somebody who has been thrown into a crisis. They're wanting to call into question the reliability of the walkthrough. And look, I get it. If Tom had actually been any of those things and this had been an actual surprise and not something that he staged, yeah, the walkthrough itself could have been subject to any of those problems. But here's the thing. It wasn't just the walkthrough. He gave these details and he gave these different stories in all of his different times with the police, not just the one walkthrough. And that's not something that Jeremy Stafford had access to. So the only thing that they brought him in for was to try to show that that walkthrough shouldn't be taken so seriously by the jury. Don't even pay attention. Look at poor Tom. Poor Tom was just thrown into the situation and it didn't play out like that. And I'll say this, the state did a great job of pointing that out. They tried to recover when they got back up for their redirect, and you know, the defense tried to save it, but I mean, at this point, it's too far gone. We all looked at that and knew exactly what that was. Okay, so now we get to the good stuff. The closing arguments are one of my favorite parts of the trial. This is where everything that we've sat through, all of the moments that we listened to, including the long, boring parts and some of the parts that were like the OMG parts, this is where all of it comes together. You create your final story and you get up there and deliver it with all of the passion that you have in you. I love this moment. It is my favorite moment of the trial, other than the conviction sometimes, depending on who it is. So the way that it works is the state goes first because they have the burden of proof. Then the defense gets to get up and give their closing arguments. And then the state goes one more time. They get to kind of give a rebuttal for everything that the defense had said. So the first section of the closing arguments for the state, they do a great job and they really just lay out all of the details. She starts out by saying, look, there were three people in this house. Two of them are dead and one of them came out with barely a scratch on him. She tells the jury that in movies, there's a writing device called an unreliable narrative. I love that she brings this up because I think she does a great job explaining what this is. It's basically saying that the narrator is an untrustworthy storyteller. She gives the example of, like, if somebody's in the park and says, hey, that guy was mean to me, but then somebody else has it on cell phone evidence that that's not how it went down. So we can look at Tom Randolph as an unreliable narrator. And boy, is he ever. So she starts pointing that out. She says, you have physical evidence. We have statements. We have ballistic evidence. All of these things show that Thomas Randolph is an unreliable narrator. And he characterizes himself as that in one of his interviews when he points out that he is, quote, reasonably honest, end quote. She shows some of the clips and she shows them back to back. There's some from the walkthrough, some from the interviews, and she starts showing all of the inconsistencies. Now, I'm not going to go through all of them because we've gone through all of them in our previous episodes, but I want to just point out kind of the basic issues that she brings up. Number one, Tom said over and over that he shot and shot and shot in that hallway, shot Mike Miller. And she points out ballistic evidence shows that absolutely is not true. Number two, Tom changes his story on the rug and when he used that rug to prop open the door. In one story, it's when he first got there and he saw Sharon. And then in another one, it was after he shot Mike Miller in the garage so that he could keep an eye on him, he propped the door open. That doesn't stay consistent either. Number three, the way that he describes shooting Mike is not consistent with the shots that actually went into the left side of his body and not the right side. Yet another problem, the way that he talks about his relationship with Mike Miller. You know, him going anywhere from saying to 911, you know, oh, I know this guy, he's tried to rip me off, to him talking about how, you know, he thought he was a druggy when he first met him, to, oh no, I trust him explicitly. His story changes so much about how he talks about him, how he looked at their relationship. I mean, it's never consistent and it's not reliable. She also brings up a good point. If Michael Miller was acting on his own and he wanted to cast suspicion away from himself, he would make it look like a forced entry. He's not going to use a key that he has to their house. Another excellent point she brings up is that Tom Randolph says that he's like the guy. He's always got money. He's always got thousands of dollars on him. He says it in multiple interviews. He even laughs at the detective's faces when they say that $20 gambling for them might be a big deal. So if Mike Miller is really there to get money, why would Sharon be the target and he wouldn't shoot Tom? If Tom's the one with money, and Tom's the one that has cash everywhere, and Mike knows that, why would he shoot Sharon and then drop his weapon and then go at Tom? It makes no sense. Also, if Mike Miller knows that Tom always has a gun on him, he wouldn't have dropped that gun and gone toward Tom anyway. And why would you drop one gun and then have to fidget with a smaller gun in your waistband or in your pocket or in your hand, depending on the story that he told? Again, it doesn't make sense. She also brings up the tattoo that defense insisted on bringing up over and over. She said, look, Sharon's not going to be the first person that gets a tattoo that she regrets that didn't age well. And it doesn't present some kind of insight into her psyche at the time or her feelings in the moment. There's no telling when she got that during their relationship, but it was probably during happier times, not the times that she was crying to her friends about wanting a divorce. And she brings up the life insurance. This is something that Tom initiated. This is something that Tom initiated with his ex-girlfriend, too. And sure, it's very common to have life insurance on your spouse when you're married, not as soon as you start dating somebody. She also points out, and oh, I could have just stood up and applauded her when she finally pointed this out, but she points out that Tom tries to make himself the hero in his story. He was the only one who cared enough about Sharon to go try to fight for her life. He literally said he tried to fight for her life. So where was all the blood on his clothes then? The crime scene photos show a lot of blood around Sharon, and he even describes how it was one of the grossest things he's ever seen in his life because there was blood coming everywhere. So if he had gone over there and knelt down beside her and was doing chest compressions, why did he have no blood on him? She also points out that he says in the video, the walkthrough, as he's down there grunting and groaning and showing how he supposedly was doing chest compressions, he says that when he went to get up, he even, you know, grabbed the doorway and pulled himself up. And he remembers that because he looked over and he left a blood print right there. There are no blood prints right there. None. Zero. It's another example of being an unreliable narrator. She points out the fact that Mike Miller's whole family thought that his relationship with Tom was not only strange, but dangerous. His cousin Clifton even told him, stop hanging out with that man. You're going to get shot. She wraps it up by talking about the jury instructions and what it means to be guilty of murder and conspiracy of murder. And then she tells them, okay, yes, he is an unreliable narrator, but the final chapter is going to be written by you, the jury. Y'all are the ones who get to decide how this story truly ends. Tom Randolph was conspiring with Mike Miller and he double-crossed him. That's the flat-out truth. And it is up to you now to make this last chapter count. I'll say this. She did a great job with her closings. And then it was defense's turn. Y'all, I'm going to tell y'all right now, I was not a fan of the defense's closing, and I'm not going to be able to pretend that I was. I am too sleep deprived and too over Tommy's nonsense to be able to pretend like this closing was any good. So I will tell you what happened, but I can probably guarantee you I'm going to sound annoyed while I'm telling you. Starts out with a bunch of drama about how this murderous Mike Miller, who Tom and Sharon loved so much that they took care of him and put boots on his feet, that he just betrayed them and showed up at his house and killed his wife, and he had a right to kill him because he's just a hero and he's just a victim and he's blah, blah, blah. You know, it's just a bunch of crap about how poor Tom. And none of it's true. I mean, look, I am all for innocent until proven guilty, but I think at this point we have beyond proven that Tom ain't innocent. So he goes on and on about how Mike Miller is the only bad guy here, and he's a thief and a liar and a burglar and everything else. Look, like I said before, Mike Miller was absolutely wrong. He was absolutely wrong for what he did. But Tom is not a victim here. Tom planned it. Tom offered to pay him. This was a whole conspiracy to get rid of his wife. So I get it. But my problem is, Mike Miller is not here to defend himself or give his side of the story. All we have is information from Tom, and we all know how reliable he is. There were a few times during these closings that I got really annoyed, and one of them was when the defense was just shocked and appalled and offended that the opening statements said something about how there was not a single bullet strike in the hallway where Tom said he shot Mike. Oh, he goes into this whole thing about how he's offended that they said this because there was a bullet strike. Okay, yeah, there was, but not where Tom said. The bullet strike that they saw was on the opposite end of the hallway, and we know that it came from Sharon, not from Mike. So this part really annoyed me because it's like he's twisting things to try to confuse the jury and try to make it look like the state was lying when it's common sense. Then the defense attorney brings up the 911 call, and he says that we can hear Tom screaming and crying, and he's so upset. And yeah, there are some noises, but here's the thing. Making noises and grunting and talking about how you're fighting for your wife's life doesn't mean anything when there's no blood on you and we can see you lied. He takes a little too far here, though, and he says that there was an orchestrated attack on the defendant. There's obviously an objection, and they approach, and there's a sidebar, and they come back, and he's not much better behaved after that. He talks about the timeline, and he says that that timeline got destroyed. He's still groveling over the whatever it was, like the extra 60 seconds or whatever. He shows the video where they stopped at the stoplight when they pulled out of the gas station, and he made a huge deal about how that is another way to destroy the state's timeline by stopping at a stoplight on the way home when that was already accounted for in the time. But okay, whatever. He tries to explain away Tom's behavior by saying he just, you know, yeah, okay, he's politically incorrect. And yeah, okay, he's a little obnoxious. And, okay, yeah, he doesn't have a filter. But, I mean, that's just who he is. So, okay, yeah, sometimes people would say maybe he's rude. But I would suggest he's born that way. And that's just who he is. And blah, blah, blah. No, it's not just that he's rude or doesn't have a filter. He's arrogant and chauvinistic. He's racist and cocky and crude. He's dishonest and vulgar and disrespectful and selfish. It's not that he doesn't have a filter. He doesn't have any self-awareness or situational awareness. You can't just excuse that away as who he is. If that's who you are, then you need to change that. But Tom doesn't see any wrong in himself. He only sees wrong in everyone else that he comes into contact with. You can't just excuse that away. He brings up the jewelry again and how it never got an appraisal done. And he brings up the ID again from Michael Hoag that was in Mike Miller's pocket. He brings up the fact that there were some arguments or discrepancies from different witnesses over whether or not they saw a dent in the refrigerator. Now, this is, again, not anything that really makes a difference in the case. You know, sometimes people see the dent and sometimes they don't. And it's not one of those things that's directly obvious right in front of you. It's not a dent on every single side. So, yeah, there were some people who noticed it and some people who didn't. But again, this is not something that helps his case. He brings up the fact that there was cocaine in Mike Miller's system, and then he does something else that really, really frustrates me. I get really frustrated when information is misrepresented, and that's exactly what he does multiple times, but this is another one of those times. He brings up the mask, and he said that DNA completely excluded Tom Randolph from that mask. That's not true. That's not what was said. Now, Tom is excluded from the inside swab of the mask. That's it. But the way that he keeps repeating it, that Tom could not have ever touched that mask, he had nothing to do with it, that's not what was said. Tom had been excluded as the DNA contributor to the inside swab. It doesn't mean anything else. And the way that he tries to use that as another gotcha moment by misrepresenting what was said is so frustrating. Then he misrepresents another thing, and he's done this before. The mask that was missing from the Miller's house. He says that she said the last time she saw it was December of 2007. And that's not what she said. That's not what she said. What she said was, oh, I don't think I've seen it since before Christmas. That's what she said. It's another misrepresentation of the information, and it's so, so frustrating. But when I'm sitting here watching at my computer and they're in Las Vegas, I don't get to object and they don't get to hear me. He closes it out by telling the jury that he believes that they have not only proven doubt, but they have proven that Tom is an innocent man.
How is it not that? How is all of this starting not to add up to terrible, terrible doubt? In fact, I don't have any burden of proof. And I don't want to say it. I think we proved he was actually innocent. If you want to find him guilty of being a cheat, a cheater, adulterer, oh, guilty. He couldn't shut up about it. Tells the police, but he doesn't hide it from anybody. Don't tell your wife that. It's rude. He does. He tells the police that. They don't have to find out. Oh, yeah, look, she, listen. It's not nice. And if that's why he's guilty, if you're a cheater and you're guilty, or you're obnoxious and you're guilty, that's so unfair. He may be those things, but you may not like him. And I suggest to you that that's innocent.
So he tells the jury, yeah, he's obnoxious and he's crude and he cheats on his wife and all of these terrible things, and you probably don't like him, but it's not fair to convict him for that. So, we're back to the state's turn. This is the last thing the jury is going to hear before they go into deliberations. Y'all, these closings were fantastic. I'm going to play a few clips, but I'll also give you like a little synopsis of what was said. He starts off by telling the jury, look, it's really, really hard to plan the perfect murder, and Tom failed at it. The story that he told does not add up to the crime scene. He picks apart the defense's theory. He says that the defense claims that the shooting happened just like Tom said it did. But let's look at it. He pulls up the diagram and he says that the directionality of the shots is really important. He plays the clip from the walkthrough where Tom is acting out how the shots happened, and he shows that there's no way that these shots could have happened that way. It's the opposite side of the body. It just doesn't line up. He also points out that Tom says that when the fire extinguisher supposedly fell, it scared him and he was standing at the doorway. Mike Miller was already on the ground in the garage and he shot him twice more. He says that's not possible. Those shots came from the top of his head, not the bottom of his feet. So once again, his story doesn't add up. This isn't something that's, oh, I maybe got this little part wrong. There's no possibility that his story is true. None. It's not just a little slip. There's no possibility it's true. Another thing, the way that he describes everything, the mask would have got blood and would have had bullet defects, and it's not there. He also never describes him taking it off. He says he has it on and he has it halfway rolled up, and then all of a sudden it's just off when he's in the garage laying on the ground. That's not possible. Ski masks don't just fall off. So he probably just took it off when he thought his job was done. Next, he points out how different the story was when he is actually on the phone with 911 and talks about getting the gun from Mike, and how different it is when he's in the walkthrough and he's telling them what supposedly happened when he was on the phone with 911 and was going to get the gun from Mike. Listen to these two clips. Two totally different stories. This is the walkthrough.
And I'm talking to the guy and I said, I don't see the gun. I says, there's some bags of stuff here. I says, there's my bag. I says, I'm into bags, and he's got one of my bags, and it's the bag that is in there on the living room table. That I think it's a Walmart bag. And he says, well, find the gun, it has to be in there. And I went over here looking to see if I could see the gun, and about that time the timer went off on the garage door, and it just went black in here, and it just scared the living hell out of me. So I got back about right here and just kind of stepped real big because I knew he was over there, and turned the door back on, turned back around, told him I couldn't find it. He told me it has to be there. If he had a gun, it has to be there. Carefully roll him over and see if it's there, or something about rolling him over. And I just put my foot on him and up on the shoulder and kind of pushed on him, and he kind of tilted that way. And when he did, then he kind of went like this, and I reached down right here. Let's see, if he was laying this way, it would have been this hand. It would have been this hand. Because he was laying... he was laying something like this, but on his head. And when I pushed him over, then his hand dropped down. And it was right here, under this hand. It wasn't... he wasn't holding it, but it was in... his hand was right by it. He was holding it, I'm assuming. But he wasn't holding it then. And I picked it up by the... I picked it up by the... I think by the wood part on it. And brought it in here, told the guy I got the gun. He said, throw it, put it somewhere in another room where it's safe, and lock the door. So I locked the door. Said, this is a lot faster.
Okay, so he just gave that account of everything that the 911 dispatcher was telling him to do. Now let's listen to the actual 911 call.
Bring down, get my gun.
That is, all of that back and forth and all of the instructions that he said that the dispatcher was giving him, that none of that happened. None of it happened. What happened is he said, I'm going to go get my gun, and then went out there, got the gun, came back, told him that he got the gun, and told him that he locked the door. None of the other stuff happened. And then the dispatcher told him, okay, we need to focus on your wife. We've got to do this fast. Another thing. Did you notice? He didn't say, I need to go check and see if he has a gun. He didn't say, I need to go get his gun. He said, I need to go get my gun. Listen again.
I'm going to put this thing down and get my gun.
I'm going to put this thing down and get my gun. Now, at this point, he allegedly hasn't seen hardly any part of the gun, maybe just a little bit of it sticking out. He doesn't know that this is his gun yet. Oh, wait, but he does, because he planned this. The prosecutor reminds the jury that this isn't the only time that he slipped up. He also said something in the report when he was with the detectives about, oh, Mike Miller had my keys. Okay, the report didn't say that. The report said there were keys. It didn't say those were his keys, but they were. They were the keys to his house. How would he know that unless he planned it? Then he points out the bags. Now, keep in mind, one of the bags had like jewelry and stuff like that in it. And then there was a Walmart bag that had like clothes and shoes and another Walmart bag that had some clothes and some sneakers. These bags were right beside Mike Miller's body. Now, there is not one time during this entire thing where Tom says anything about him holding bags while he's coming down the hallway. He only says something about a gun. So why would there be bags right there? It's not like he would have put them right there in the garage for safekeeping while he's robbing the place, if that's what he's robbing the place with. And if that's not the door he came in anyway, why would they be right there? It doesn't make sense. He shows two clips back to back with another inconsistency. In one video, he says that he found the .38 gun that was used to kill her because he knelt down by her body and his knee was on it when he knelt down and it was uncomfortable, so he moved it. In another video, he says that he knelt down by her body and then there was a box right there and he moved the box and then that's when he saw the gun under the box. Two very different stories with specific details. These are not just small things that he mixes up. Then he brings out the 911 records. All that mess about how he called 911 and he didn't get through this time, and then he called again and it was busy, and then he had to call again. No, there is one time on that phone record. There is one time that he called 911, and he shows the jury the phone records. He brings out the ever-changing story about the money. First, it was he withdrew $20,000 from the bank, and Mike knew that, so he was going to come rob him. And then it was, well, I never actually made it to the bank, but I was only going to the bank. I was actually going to withdraw $6,000 or $7,000, but we didn't make it. I made a wrong turn. None of that stuff is true. They have his bank records. Not only did he not take $20,000 out of the bank, but he also didn't even have $20,000 to take out. He didn't even have the $6,000 or $7,000 to take out that he said that he was going to deposit. He doesn't have any of that. They play all the clips back to back to back where Tom is complaining about money, and he's complaining about the money that Sharon is spending when she's gambling, and he's complaining about these bills and that bills and who doesn't take care of money and who doesn't do this. Everything is about money, and he buries himself with this. They play back-to-back clips, and the jury clearly can see the motive. Then he points out that's not the only motive. Liz gave him an ultimatum and told him, it's her or me. You have to pick one or the other. And what was his response? I'll take care of it. So now he lays it out. He lays everything out for the jury to see. If Sharon is alive, that means that not only does he not get to continue his affair with Liz, it means that he owes $84,000. He has no actual income to speak of, and he has helped Sharon blow through all of the insurance money that came from her late husband. He would be forced to file taxes with Sharon, which makes him have to pay the taxes from her late husband. And Sharon has a gambling problem, so he doesn't want her spending all the money. But if he has her killed, then not only does he get to continue his affair with Liz, but he'll get $332,000 in life insurance. He believes he's getting a home to inherit, and he doesn't have to worry about Sharon's spending issues anymore. He tells the jury, look, this is not justifiable homicide. This is not self-defense. You don't get to claim self-defense when you planned the entire thing. He said he conspired with Mike Miller, and then he double-crossed him. He said when they're looking at the jury instructions for the reasonable doubt, the instruction reads that for doubt to be reasonable, it must be actual, not near possibility or speculation. It has to be actual. And in this case, he says, there is no reasonable doubt. So with that, the jury begins deliberations. There's only about half an hour left at the end of this day. So the judge rules that they are allowed to still go home, get a full night's sleep. They leave at the regular time of 5 o'clock and report back the next day. They spend about a total of a little over 4.5 hours deliberating, and then we reach a verdict.
Mr. Dyer, has the jury reached a verdict?
Yes, ma'am.
If you could please pass the verdict form to the marshal. The clerk will now read the verdict.
District Court, Clark County, Nevada. State of Nevada Plaintiff versus Thomas William Randolph, Defendant. Case number 09C250966, Department 10. Verdict. We, the jury, in the above entitled case, find the defendant, Thomas William Randolph, as follows. Count 1, conspiracy to commit murder. Guilty of conspiracy to commit murder. Count 2, murder with use of a deadly weapon, Sharon Randolph. Guilty of first-degree murder with use of a deadly weapon. Count 3, murder with use of a deadly weapon, Michael Miller. Guilty of first-degree murder with use of a deadly weapon. Dated this 24th day of August, 2023, signed David Dyer. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, are these your verdicts as read? So say you one, so say you all.
Yes.
And with that, we have a guilty verdict. Guilty on all counts. Now, before the trial started, Tom agreed to have the judge in charge of his sentencing instead of the jury. So the jury is dismissed, and the sentencing will actually be held on October 12th. So I will update you on the sentencing, but we can pretty much expect it to be life without parole. I'm glad that the jury got this one right. There were some interviews with Colleen directly after, and the relief and the exhaustion in her face was evident, and I know that this has just put such a toll on her, and I'm so glad that she's able to finally put this behind her once and for all. With every trial that I cover, I think, wow, this one was a crazy one, and this is no exception. This was a crazy story. I'll definitely be interested to see if any of the jurors do any kind of interviews and see what they have to say and what was going through their minds, especially when they find out about all of the past that they didn't get to hear about during the trial. It's always a good day when you get to see justice served. But if there's one thing that I've learned about Thomas Randolph, it's that Thomas Randolph loves to hear Thomas Randolph. I'm sure there will be some interviews in the future, and from what I hear, there's going to be a Netflix special as well. So we haven't heard the last of old Tommy Boy. So that does it for now. Please like, subscribe, give us a good review, and share with a friend. I appreciate y'all reporting for jury duty. My name is Brandy Churchwell, and I'll see y'all at the next trial.